Okay, the failure of atheistic arguments. Introduction. This is Apologetics 2, lecture number 14. Failure of atheistic arguments. Atheism is the belief that God definitely does not exist. Now, there's Michael Martin. That's the historic definition of atheism. The positive belief that God does not exist, okay? And I don't mean positive like they know it positively, but I mean it is a, it's not just questioning God's existence. It is an actual belief that God does not exist. Agnosticism, though, is the belief that man cannot know if God exists. Now, there's a softer form of agnosticism, the belief that man doesn't know that God exists, but it's possible that maybe there will be an argument. Maybe you will find out that God does exist later on. Or a person, a real soft form of agnosticism would be, well, I don't know if God exists, but maybe you can prove it to me. Well, those leave the door wide open for us anyway, so there's no need for us to refute them, okay? Because just as we make a defense of the faith, we're actually dealing with that. What we have to refute is the strong form of agnosticism and the traditional view of atheism. Atheism, the belief that God definitely does not exist, and agnosticism, the belief that strong agnosticism, the belief, or hard agnosticism, the belief that man cannot know if God exists, okay? Both are self-refuting. This opens the door wide open for theistic apologetics, for arguments for God's existence. Because atheism, in order to disprove the existence of God, you would really have to be all-knowing. To disprove any possibility of God's existence, you would have to be all-knowing. You'd have to be not only omniscient, you'd have to be omnipresent, present everywhere at once. Because maybe when you're in one corner of the universe making sure God's not there, maybe he's hiding in another corner of the universe. Kind of like the hunters, when they go hunting, they found that they thought, hey, there's a whole mess of deer in that area. We know they're there. We got guys hunting for 2 weeks, they haven't seen one deer yet. And then they found out in a controlled test that deer have the tendency, the instinct, to follow hunters at a safe distance wherever they're going. So no matter where the hunter goes, because hunters don't usually backtrack, they'll never find the deer. And so maybe God's doing that. Maybe God is, when the guy's looking in this corner of the universe, maybe God's hiding in the other corner. So you'd have to be everywhere present at once to disprove that God doesn't exist in the physical universe. But then if the Christians are right and there's a spiritual dimension beyond the physical dimension, you'd have to be all-knowing and all-seeing in both the physical and the spiritual dimension. And so basically, the only way to disprove God's existence, to leave no possibility for the existence of God, you would have to have the attributes of God yourself. So atheism self-refutes there. Agnosticism, it doesn't mean that it proves God's existence. What it does show is there's no way to disprove God's existence. Okay? Agnosticism, see, here's the way it is, okay? Let's say there's an infinite number, obviously it's impossible for this to be the case, but let's say there's an infinite number of white ping pong balls all in one big pile, and there's one red ping pong ball. Okay? It is possible to prove the existence of the red ping pong ball because you might have experienced it and be able to show it to others. But it's impossible to disprove the existence of the red ping pong ball, even if the red ping pong ball didn't exist. Because no matter how many white ping pong balls you found, there's still more ping pong balls out there that you haven't examined yet. And it's always possible that next ping pong ball you pick up is going to be red rather than white. So what's that deal? It's the impossibility of proving a universal negative is the way they call it, okay? Now, there are universal negatives that you can prove. Universal, but that would be a small universal set. Like, for instance, like all the chairs, there are no chairs in this room that are red.
That's not a universal negative, though.
No, yeah, it is, because it's a universal set. It's all the chairs in this room. But what it is, it's a limited universal set. You see what I'm getting at? It's because it's universal. It's talking about every chair in this room. Okay? But once you take the boundaries of this room and all boundaries and remove it and say there exists no red chair anywhere, then you've got a problem. Okay? So the only universal negatives, and in other words, you can...
Would you call it an unlimited universal negative?
Yeah, not? Yeah, you could. And then that's the basic way it's understood. The problem is, usually whenever you say all or nothing, then you're talking universals. But those all or nothings can be put into a smaller context, and so it would be universal to that room, but it wouldn't be universal outside of that room.
Isn't that a misuse of the term universal, though?
Because not really, because you, in a sense that... because once you get your universal, then you can deduce from it. So if the set that we're dealing with is all the chairs in this room, once you determine the color of all the chairs in this room, you can deduce statements from that. You have a universal premise then at that point, okay? But it's a highly limited universal is what I'm getting at. But if we think of universal just in the sense of anywhere, I mean, in this universe, maybe in possible worlds, whatever, then it's impossible to prove a universal negative, okay? And that's not saying with a high degree of probability, okay? In other words...
Now, if you've got a limited universal, all the chairs in this room, then in order to prove or disprove a universal statement, you have to have omissions. Well, you've got your limited omissions, because you can go and check every chair in this room. So that would still kind of hold that same rule still holds up, because you can't prove it or disprove without omissions, but in the limited setting you can have limited omissions.
Well, I would
hold up.
No, I would say here, well, one thing we have to assume for any time you deal with sense data is the basic reliability of sense perception.
Right, we'll grant that.
Well, if we grant that and we grant that we're not being deceived, then again, what we're talking about, I'm just showing that there is an area where a universal set, you can prove a universal negative if that universal set, all those things, are in a limited, it's a limited deal. Something like,
right,
all the cars in my driveway.
But you still have to have a limited omissions. You have to actually observe every single item in your set. Because
yes.
if I'm looking in this direction,
yeah,
all I see is these five chairs, and I say, based on that, there are no red chairs in the room.
What I would say, yeah, you would have to, but it would not be an exhaustive all knowledge. So that you,
within our limited family.
As long as you grant certain things, it will be knowledge. I wouldn't call it omniscience. I'd call it the knowledge of all the data within your set.
Right. Okay.
But the reason why the atheist needs omniscience is because he's saying God does not exist anywhere. Period. And so that's a big universal set. That's everything that exists.
Well, you're talking about a priori knowledge, right? So
and that's what I'm getting at. And it's so all, if you're using all or nothing in a purely universal sense, That's what the atheist is trying to do and trying to disprove God. That's why most atheists, Martin calls himself an atheist, but he's redefined atheism. At least Bertrand Russell was honest and admitted he wasn't really an atheist, he was an agnostic. Well, he's not really being honest. And because he really was an atheist, but he knew he couldn't prove atheism. He knew the impossibility of proving atheism, so in his debate with Father Copleston, he referred to himself as an agnostic. He just believed... believed that there wasn't any... The evidence was just so insufficient that only a fool would believe in God's existence. But agnosticism also self-refutes, because you must know something about God in order to know that nothing can be known about God. Okay? The claim that man cannot know God is the claim to know... a guy says, man cannot know anything about God. Well, that's a claim to know something about God, i.e., that nothing can be known about him. So that self-refutes too. So in both cases, they're arguing for too much, and it leaves the door open for theism. Some agnostics would say, look, even if the infinite exists, the finite cannot reach the infinite on its own. Therefore, the finite can attain no knowledge of the infinite. Okay? Well, what they fail to realize is, the finite's hands are tied, but the infinite's hands aren't tied. If the infinite is infinite, if the infinite is unlimited, why can't the infinite reach the finite and reveal himself to the finite and save the finite even? And that's what Jesus said in Matthew 19:25-26. They asked Jesus, how can man be saved? Jesus said, this is impossible for man, but all things are possible with God. So in other words, the finite, limited, sinful man can't reach the infinite, holy, and just God on his own. So if man is to be saved, he must look to the infinite, holy, just God, whose hands are not tied, and can choose to save man. Hey, you had some, Jeff?
I was going to say, this is an issue that we're dealing with philosophy of transcendence and limitedness.
There are certain things that we cannot transcend, but our God, being infinite, he can bridge the gap. Man can't bridge the gap from man to God, but God can bridge the gap from God to man. Yeah. Also, with God's immanence and transcendence, we need a God who is imminent enough, he's near enough to us to feel our pain, to care about our problems. Peter says, casting all our cares upon him, for he careth for you. So we need a God imminent enough to care about our problems. At the same time, if he's too imminent, then he's also going to be battered and beaten by our problems just like we are. So he needs to be transcendent enough, above our problems enough, to be able to solve our problems for us. But what I'm getting at is atheism and agnosticism do not close the book on Christian theism, and therefore we can argue, because of the failure of atheism and agnosticism, we can begin. It is possible that God exists, and therefore we need to look at arguments for God's existence. A lot of people think that Freud and Feuerbach proved that God was just a product of man's imagination. Okay? But that was not the case. Ludwig Feuerbach taught that due to man's fear of death, man created God by his own imagination. God is what man wishes to be. Okay? I'll tell you, the funny thing is, Friedrich Nietzsche, in his writings, his supermen, you can make an argument that the supermen were what everything that Nietzsche wasn't and everything that Nietzsche wished to be. So these guys, there's an element of truth to what they're saying. We do have the ability to create gods by our imagination. The question is, could we create the God of the Bible by our imagination? And even if we could, the question is, did we, or does he exist? But Feuerbach argued that due to man's fear of death, man created God by his imagination. Sigmund Freud argued that due to man's guilt for hating his father... See, Freud assumed he was normal, and the warped, perverted views that he held to, he projected, using Freudian language, he projected that on everybody else, okay? And he assumed that all little boys grow up desiring to have sex with their mother. I never desired to have sex with my mother, so I guess I was weird in Freud's view. But Freud believed every boy grows up wanting to have sex with his mother, and therefore he hates his father, and he feels guilty for hating his father. So due to man's guilt for hating his father and man's fear of nature, you know, earthquakes and tornadoes and lightning and thunder, due to man's guilt for hating his father and man's fear of nature, man deifies nature and personalizes it. He takes impersonal nature and views it as a personal being, and he deifies it. He makes it a personal god, and he calls it the Father God. Okay? See, Freud's... What's actually... Look down at point D. R.C. Sproul, in his book, it used to be called The Psychology of Atheism, but I think now he changed the title to If God Exists, Why Are There Atheists? Excellent book. This was never meant to be an argument against God's existence. Feuerbach and Freud, even Friedrich Nietzsche, who we're going to cover a little bit later, these guys were not trying to disprove God's existence. You see, they already assumed that God did not exist. They assumed that modern science disproved God's existence, which it could never do. How could you, even if modern science examined every atom in the entire universe, there would still be no way to disprove God's existence. That's ludicrous. How can you disprove the existence of a spiritual God by examining every aspect of the physical universe, which science hasn't even touched, you know, one little tiny atom of the universe when you know, in comparison to the whole entire universe. But it's not actually an argument against God's existence. Rather, it was an attempt by atheists to explain why so many people believed in a non-existent God. In other words, they assumed that no God exists, and then they realized they had a problem. Here you got less than 10% of the people in the world, atheists, looking out and saying, well, why are 90% of the people wrong? And so they try to figure out, well, how could these people all be mistaken? Rather than asking themselves, hey, maybe we're wrong. Maybe 90% of the people on Earth are right, and maybe we're the ones who are messed up. But anyway, this explains false idols. Even the book of Isaiah talks about how men create gods by their own imaginations. This explains false idols, but no one would wish for the God of the Bible. Okay? Let's face it. To get to first base with the God of the Bible, you got to admit you're a sinner who can't save yourself. You deserve the flames of hell. And that there is not only do you need to be changed, but there's lots of changes that need to be done in your life. Nobody would invent that God. The New Age God, that'd be the kind of God I'd invent, where I can call myself God, I can worship myself, and anything I do, I can justify. Because after all, I'm God. Friedrich Nietzsche argued that God is dead and traditional values have therefore died with him. See, what he was saying was, Nietzsche argued that, he was saying to his fellow atheists, you guys are right on, God doesn't exist, but then you guys still live like God exists. You guys need to recognize that if we're right, if God doesn't exist, then the traditional biblical moral values have died with him. Then Nietzsche said that we need a breed of supermen who have the courage to create their own hard values rather than the soft values of Christianity. He thought the soft values of Christianity were holding man back from fully expressing himself, fully expressing his creativity. Now, Adolf Hitler thought the writings of Nietzsche were pretty good. And Nietzsche, by the way, thought that he died in 1900, he thought that the 20th century man would be the atheist man come of age. That he would apply his principles of atheism to his moral life, and because of it, he predicted that the 20th century would be the bloodiest century in the history of mankind, and he was right. But Adolf Hitler applied these principles to his life. His master race was an attempt at the supermen. They created their own hard values rather than the soft values of Christianity, and because of it, millions of innocent people were barbarically murdered. J.P. Moreland, in his Scaling the Secular City, he quotes from Paul Vitz, or he paraphrases Paul Vitz, a Roman Catholic psychologist who, the more and more he studies his own field, the less and less he admires it. He talks about psychology as a, wrote one book about psychology as a religion, and just really slams Freud and a lot of stuff. But he says, and Witz argues that in Freudian language, see, Freud argued that the first tribe of humans actually killed their father, the boys killed their father because they wanted to have sex with their mother, with their mothers, plural, because the first tribe was polygamous, apparently, according to Freud. And so then they felt guilty, so they ritualistically ate their father and then created an animal sacrifice and a that type of thing. So a real warped view, but Witz argues that in Freudian language, the atheist can be accused, rather than the Christian being accused of creating the father image, the atheist can be accused of trying to kill the father image. And then Witz would argue, like Moreland does, you can't put Christians come from all walks of life, all different family backgrounds. You got orphans who become Christians, kids whose fathers beat them up who become Christians, kids whose fathers love them become Christians. But then with atheists, a very high percentage of them seems to be this test group. Seems to be a group of guys who either had an absent or passive father. So it can be argued that most atheists hated their fathers, at least the founders of atheism, hated their fathers and grew up wanting to kill the father image. Because they hated their human father, they wanted to kill the divine father. In other words, 90% of men are probably, of mankind is probably not neurotic, is not psychotic, I should say, but maybe the atheists are. And so if anybody's got a problem, it's going to come from the atheist camp. But keep in mind, this was not even, this is used as an argument. Freud disproved God's, it wasn't even an argument. It was an attempt to explain away the fact that so few people held to their belief as true. So few people held to atheism as truth. So they basically were trying to explain away some of the strong evidence against their view. So it wasn't like Freud put Christianity on the ropes. It was like, it was as if Freud was trying to explain why Christianity had him on the ropes. But you had something to jump.
Is 90% still an accurate number for a percentage of people who believe in a God of some kind?
It's a... 90% is pretty generous. It's pretty generous to the atheist.
Oh, really?
I think it would be pretty hard to prove that there was ever, at any time in the history of mankind, more than 10% of people that were atheists. Most people who are atheistic, even Buddhists who are atheistic, usually sound more like pantheists in a lot of areas, but even if you grant that that a lot of Buddhists are atheists, you still have a very small percentage overall. And in this country, it's, I think right now, and it's at our most carnal state, it's between 5 and 7%. So I mean, even if you have a country abandoning Christianity and living immorally, you're still going to have 93-94% of your people believing in some type of God. They might be pantheist, they might be panentheist, they might be deist, they might not be theist or Christian theist, but very rarely does... It's just... Every culture has an idea of God. And you could even argue that it would be impossible for finite man to come up with an idea of the infinite God, of the God of Christianity, that you could see man inventing the other types or whatever, or perverting God's witness in nature and coming up with the other views. But I think it'd be a real tough case to say that a guy would either want to come up with the God of Christianity, or you might even be able to make the case he wouldn't even rationally be able to think up an idea such as the God of Christianity if it wasn't placed in his mind already by God himself. A.J. Ayer with Logical Positivism. was a school of thought that had the verification principle as its starting point. The verification principle taught that truth can only be found, well, the verification principle taught more than just this. Truth can only be found two ways. Truth can only be found through the five senses, or it had to be true by definition, okay? But if it's true by definition, it tells us nothing about the real world. It only tells us about the possible world, okay? So, really, truth can only be found through the five senses. That's all we can learn of the real world. But let's use both definitions. And because of this, God talk is meaningless, because God isn't true by definition, and God cannot be known through the five senses, proven true through the five senses. Problem with this view is that the verification principle itself is not true by definition, and it also cannot be proven true through the five senses. So the verification principle is true, it has to be false. It refutes itself. It fails its own test for truth. Others would argue that God talk is meaningless because if God is infinite and man is finite, if we say that God talk is univocal, totally the same, then we would say that to say that God is holy and that man is holy is to say that the holy means the same thing and is applied the same way to God and man. But then what we've done is, univocal language, we drag God down to where God becomes one of us. Okay? If we use equivocal language, though, and say, okay, well, when we say God is holy and man is holy, holy means something totally different for God than it means for man, then we have total agnosticism. We can know nothing of God. Okay? So again, God talk is meaningless. Okay? God becomes the totally other. We can't know him at all. Analogical God talk says, well, the term holiness means a similar. Holiness means something similar to man as it means to God. The meaning is similar, though not the same. Well, the fact of the matter is, if it's similar, it means it's not exactly the same. We don't know how close or how far it is. Okay? And because we don't know how far or how close, we still end up with agnosticism. And so this dilemma, how we can talk about God, this dilemma leaves us in a situation where we just throw up our hands. We have no real knowledge of God. Well, Thomas Aquinas settled this issue by arguing that we use univocal terms that are with totally the same meaning. Holiness is defined the same for man as it is for God, but it's applied in an analogical, similar manner, not in the same exact manner. In other words, man is holy in a finite sense. God is holy in an infinite sense. But we do know what holiness means when applied to God. We just can't fully comprehend, exhaustively comprehend, how holiness can be applied infinitely. Okay, so what it's saying is, it's like our knowledge of God is like arrows shooting towards the target, though we never totally hit it. We can know true truths about God, we just can't know God exhaustively. Okay? So Aquinas settled that dilemma. You need a univocal aspect. The terms have to be defined the same, though it cannot be applied univocally. It has to be applied analogically. So God talk is not meaningless. We can talk about God, and that's what we're doing in a course like this. Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, argued that the Christian concept of God is a self-caused being. But if God is self-caused, then he's an impossible being, because for being to be self-caused, he would have to pre-exist his own existence in order to cause his own existence. Okay? The Christian response, though, is that no informed Christian would call God self-caused, although Ronald Nash calls God self-caused in his his book, Faith and Reason. I don't know why. He means uncaused, but it's just a philosophy 101 mistake. Maybe if he gave Aquinas, held Aquinas in a little bit higher regard, he wouldn't make mistakes like that. An informed Christian wouldn't argue that God is self-caused. He would argue that God is uncaused. God is without a cause, rather than God being his own cause. Now, I don't want to get into the big mumbo-jumbo, but I believe to say when Aquinas said God is self-existent, and when Leibniz said God is self-explained, what they meant was that God is uncaused. So God contains in himself his own explanation for existence, and that explanation is he is by nature uncaused, not self-caused. So in other words, to say God is self-explained or self-existent means God is uncaused. It doesn't mean that God is self-caused. It's a different thing is being stated there. And there's no contradiction in an uncaused being. An uncaused being means a being who has no beginning and no end and no possibility to not exist. It doesn't mean that he had to pre-exist his own existence in order to bring it about. Sartre also argued that Sartre's number one premise in his philosophy is that man is free. Free to actualize, free to create meaning for his life, free to define himself. He comes into existence with no definition, no essence. And so Sartre argues, since man is free, God cannot exist. In other words, if man is free, then God cannot predetermine anything. And the God of the Bible could not exist. Response to this, all we have to assume is that God is sovereign, he is in control, but he sovereignly chose to make man free, to give man freedom. Not absolute freedom like Sartre would give us. You know, God gives us freedom to jump off a 10-story building, but not freedom to change our minds and to stop halfway down, okay? We're free to reject Christ until the day we die, but we're not free to reject Christ till the day we die and still go to heaven, okay? So we have limited freedom, and God sovereignly chose to give man limited freedom and has predetermined that man's limited freedom will not override God's sovereign purposes. And therefore there's no contradiction there. Bertrand Russell, the great British philosopher, argued that if everything needs a cause, then so does God. But if God doesn't need a cause, then neither does the universe. Response to this is real simple. Number one, any Christian who argues everything needs a cause, anybody who argues that everything needs a cause, right off the bat, you're arguing against God to begin with. What the Christian needs to argue is that only that which has a beginning needs a cause, and everything except God has a beginning. Therefore, there has to be something without a beginning that caused the existence of everything that has a beginning. Okay? So only temporary existence needs a cause. Therefore, there has to be some eternal existent being that is the cause of all temporary existence. And also, there's good, solid scientific and philosophical evidence that the universe had a beginning. We'll go over that when we get to the Kalam cosmological argument. And therefore, not everything needs a cause, because it is possible that an eternal being exists, and there's good evidence that an eternal being exists, and God doesn't need a cause, but the universe still needs a cause. There's overwhelming scientific and philosophical evidence that the universe needs a beginning. The argument from the existence of evil, I can't remember if we're going to handle this separately or not in this course. I think we're going to need to deal with this. The argument from the existence of evil. Yeah, that's right. It was philosophy of religion. We dealt with it separately. Okay, the argument from the existence of evil. It's actually two arguments here. The metaphysical problem of evil. If God created all things, if God created everything that exists, and evil exists, then we, it seems like we're demanded that God created evil. Okay? And so we have to explain how evil, how God could create everything, yet evil is a thing that exists, yet God didn't create evil. Okay? That's one problem of evil. The second problem of evil is the moral problem of evil, and that's the one that I've got listed here in the handout. An all-good God would want to destroy evil. An all-powerful God is able to destroy evil, but evil is not destroyed. It still exists. Therefore, there is no all-good and all-powerful God that exists, okay? The Christian response to this, number one, there's an unnecessary time limit placed on God. In other words, it's assumed that if evil still exists, therefore is going to continue to exist. God is never going to defeat it. So an unnecessary time limit is placed on God. It could be that God is in the process of defeating evil, which is what the Bible teaches. By the way, atheists act like the problem of evil is a real major problem for Christianity and the Bible. God would not have written the Bible if it wasn't for the fact of the problem of evil. In other words, the Bible is a response to the problem of evil. Okay? The atheist is the one who has the problem of evil, because if there is no God, there is no such thing as evil. So he wouldn't even be able to raise the objection. Point number two in the Christian response, God did not create evil itself. He created the possibility for evil. In other words, God gave us human and angelic free will. When we actualized the possibility for evil by abusing free will and choosing evil, then we brought evil into existence. Okay, you see what I'm getting at? God created us with the ability of perverting His perfect creation. He didn't pervert His perfect creation. We did. So we actualized that potential. So we brought evil into existence. We didn't create it, but evil exists, as Aquinas and Augustine would say, as a privation. A privation is not just a lack of something. Okay? For instance, a rock cannot see. A rock lacks sight, but that's not a privation. A privation is a lack of something that should be there. A rock was not meant to have sight. So the fact that a rock cannot see is not a privation or a perversion or a corruption, okay? But the lack of sight in a human being who was created, one of his purposes was he was created to see. And so that was the lack of an attribute that should be there, the lack of a perfection that should be there. That's what a privation is. A lack of something, a lack of a perfection that should be there. And so evil is a privation or a perversion or a corruption of God's good creation. In other words, it's like automobile manufacturers do not produce rust. They produce cars. But a corruption of those cars would be the rust that's produced in those cars. Okay? So God, in His perfect creation, created precious metals, but a perversion of that would be rust. Okay? So evil is a real thing. It really does exist, but it exists as a privation or a parasite in something that is good. Okay? Also, God, point number three, God allows evil for the purpose of a greater good. I.e. human free will. If God decided that He was not going to allow the possibility for evil, then He would have to create us as robots and not as free human beings with the ability to choose to rebel against God. Point number four, God's love cannot be forced on His creatures. God's love and His will cannot be forced on His creatures. In other words, God has given us the freedom to reject his love and the freedom to reject his will, and therefore, by giving us human free will and by God loving us, he could not force us to obey him, and therefore he allowed us to turn our backs on him and to go against him, and thus bring evil, pervert God's good creation. Also, point number five, the Christian does not have to argue that this is the greatest possible world. The Christian can merely argue that this is the greatest possible way to achieve the greatest possible world, and the greatest possible world is heaven, where you have everyone living, submitting to God in a love relationship with God, but of their own choice. They freely chose to be there. God didn't force his love on his creation. Point number six, in the Christian response to the problem of evil, man's free choice brought evil and human suffering into the world. God did create the world with the possibility of evil and human suffering, but it was man's free choice's abuse of the freedom that God gave him that brought evil and human suffering into the world. Point number seven, God will use evil for good purposes. For instance, God, if there was no evil, we could only love our friends. We would not be able to love our enemies, because if there's no evil in existence, there would be no enemies. Courage, you know, courage is a good thing. It's a good attribute. At the same time, there would be, if there's nothing evil to be afraid of, if there's nothing evil to fear, there would be no way we could have courage. As Isaiah 55:8-9 says, that God's ways and his thoughts are as far above ours as the heavens are above the earth. And therefore, God promises to use evil for good purposes, even if we can't understand how God could use the evil of a Ted Bundy, a serial murderer, for good. Still, God promises that he will, and in his infinite wisdom, there are ways that he can do that that we cannot understand. Just as a child, a father allows the child that he loves to experience the pain of surgery for the purpose of a greater good to save his life, and the child doesn't understand it, so too, we are like children before God. We can't understand, God, why did you allow my loved one to die? But God allows it for the purpose of a greater good. His ways and his thoughts are far above ours. So just as a child cannot understand why his father allows him to go through the pain of surgery, so too our Heavenly Father allows evil for good purposes and a greater good that we don't always understand. As I mentioned before, point number eight, atheists usually deny the existence of evil. Yet, they throw evil in the Christian's face to deny the existence of God. The fact of the matter is, though, C.S. Lewis, who used to use the problem of evil to deny God's existence when he was an atheist, after a while, after he became a Christian, he recognized that it actually backfires into an argument for God's existence. Because if you admit, see, before the atheist, you know, it's not like the atheist is just assuming evil for the sake of argument. He is actually saying there are certain things that are evil, and that disproves your God. Okay? But once the atheist admits that something is evil, you know, you have to ask him, well, define what you mean by evil. And the only solid definition of that which is evil is a perversion of that which is ultimately good. And that which is ultimately good is what the Christian calls God, the ultimate standard of perfection. And anything that falls short of that or perverts that or corrupts that perfect standard is evil. So the atheist, Once he accepts the existence of evil, he's not far from the throne room of God, and will usually end up denying evil, but then he throws out his biggest argument. Yeah?
So you can condense it by saying good exists, but evil sucks.
Yeah. evil. It's like Aquinas argued that if the universe was totally evil, it would be non-existent. Because evil is only a removal or a lack of a good which should be there, and if the good which should be there was totally removed, it would be non-existent. And this is perfectly, John Calvin, with his view of total depravity, would have no problem with that. Because even an unsaved man, he was still created in God's image, and though that image is marred, there is still a certain degree to where he reflects the image of God in a way that the animals don't. Point number 9 in the Christian response, God will defeat evil through Christ's death, resurrection, and return. And point number 10, evil is a horrible thing that man has to deal with, but the fact of the matter is the God of the Bible is the only guarantee that evil will ultimately be defeated. I don't even see how man could have a hope that evil will someday be defeated apart from the God of the Bible. He alone is our guarantee that evil will ultimately be defeated. We'll continue with the failure of atheism next week. Thank you.